Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Nun Chedem and Aleph by the two dots. Gemara here, after telling a number of memorot from Rabbi Benoah, is actually going to speak about Rabbi Benoah himself. Rabbi Benoah seemingly was a Tano from the very late period of the Tanaim, because on the previous Amud, we had Rabbi Yochanan, who is the first generation Amora in Eretz Yisrael, quoting Rabbi Benoah. And it seems that Rabbi Yochanan was querying him, was asking questions of him so that he learned by him, which would also indicate that he was in Eretz Yisrael, and he was at some period towards the end of the period of the Tanaim. And now it speaks about him as an individual, that Rabbi Benoah, amongst his jobs or things that he undertook, were Havikah Mitzayin Marto. He used to go and demarcate all the graves. So it seems obvious that the reason that he was going around and doing this was because of issues of Tumah. The graves or the Kvarim are problems of Tumah. In order to be mitzayin, which is a requirement that you put lime or something white on top of it, in order to indicate to Kohanim and people who want to remain tahor that there is a grave over here, don't walk over here. Now, the issue is that their graves were actually dug into the bedrock. They were caves, or they were kuchin, which we're going to see later in the Masechta. And so therefore, if you knew where the opening was, it didn't necessarily indicate to you where the tumah was held, or how big the cave below was, or the burial area. So what he would do is he would enter below, measure it out, and then demarcate it on top as to the extent of the me'arah. So that would be with regards to the issues of tumah. The problem, as the Balei HaTosafot point out already, is that the stories or upcoming stories seem to be speaking about individuals who were before Matan Torah. And so here the Balei HaTosafot take up an issue, which is, first of all, we have a machloket tanaim as to whether nachrim, goyim, are mitamei ba'ohel. Machloket chachamim in Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon believes that only Jews are mitamei ba'ohel. A goy is mitamei b'maga u'b'masa, but not be'ohel. And if we paskin like Rabbi Shimon, then the upcoming stories about him demarcating or indicating where the ma'arot are a little strange, because we're talking about individuals who are classified as Bnei Noach. So then why was he worried about Tumat Ha'ol at all? So there are a number of ways to deal with that. One of them, the Balei HaTosafot dismisses, which is that some say that Bnei Noach, before the Dibur, before Har-Sinai, everybody had the status of Mitamei Ohel. Only after Har-Sinai was this bifurcation of the din between Jews and non-Jews. Tosafot rejects that based on the limud of the Gemara, that it seems that the riboy of Bnei Noach, or those that were before Har-Sinai, was only in terms of maga, of contact. But Tumat Ohel did not exist, and therefore that could not be the answer to the problem. The other possibility is that we don't paskin like Rabbi Shimon, which we saw previously, that the Rabbeinu Tam favors heavily paskening against Rabbi Shimon, and that we paskin like the Chachamim, that even Goyim are mitamei bohel. Obviously, that would help the cause over here, but the majority of Rishonim, according to the Balei HaTosafot over here, seem to indicate we do paskin like Rabbi Shimon. Then you have to come up with other reasons as to why he's demarcating or delineating these mi'arot that involve people before Matan Torah, or people that are not necessarily Am Yisrael or Yisrael. So the Tosafot over here says, "Yesh lamar de Abraham nikra Adam, dichtiv Adam agadol, chen Adam rishon, and so too Adam rishon." So Abraham and Adam rishon have a unique title of Adam, and given that the pasuk in Yechezkel, which is quoted to determine who is classified as a person who is mitamei ba'ohel, uses the term Adam, and that is based on the pasuk in Parshat Chukat. We just read Parshat Parah. Zot HaTorah Adam Ki Yamut Be'ohel. And then they quote the pasuk from Yechezkel, which says, Atem Kurim Adam. That you, Jews, are called Adam, but not the non-Jews, because it says, Atem Soni Tzon Mariti. And it references to Bnei Yisrael, the term Adam. So here, what the Tosafot does in the end says is that Adam Arishon and Yaakov and Avram Avinu also had the title Adam, and therefore they'd be subsumed under this halacha. It also might relate to the Rabbeinu Tam's shita with regards to the difference between Adam and Ha-Adam, as to how do we distinguish when is the Torah, when it uses the term Adam, when does it include non-Jews, because it's the generic Adam rather than Israel, and when does it only include Jews and not non-Jews. And so also here, the word Adam, or calling them Adam, might have meaning. In addition, you could obviously understand that maybe they are unique. these individuals are unique because they were the fathers either of the world or of Judaism. And therefore, they have a unique standing. They're mitamei bo'el because of that unique standing, not because every goy, every person was mitamei bo'el. And that leads us to, again, the upcoming story where under two things you might conclude from here. One is that kivrei tzadikim are mitamim, that the kvarim of tzadikim are mitamei. There are those opinions that say that tzadikim or kivrei tzadikim are not mitamei. From here, from the work of Rabbi Banah, it seems that they were. And number two is the Ramban writes over here that there's a value to delineating or demarcating these kvarim, not because of tumah, but because of the fact that these are tzadikim. Now, he doesn't say the obvious thing, which is, oh, well, if you know where the kivrei tzadikim are, then you can daven over there. That's not what he says. He says that you want to delineate or demarcate them because it would be inappropriate to walk on top of them. I mean, out of respect for those individuals who are gedolim or tzadikim, we don't want to be trampling on their mi'arot or over them. And so it's proper kavod amet not to walk on those areas, and that's why he's delineating them. Again, the idea or the concept of davening by kivrei tzadikim is somewhat precarious because in Judaism, we don't daven to the meitim, we don't daven to individuals, we always daven to Hashem. And so therefore, davening to Hashem at the place of the tzadikim shouldn't matter because you could daven anywhere. So what they generally is said is that the location of the tzadikim, either we are davening to Hashem, and hopefully since we're at the kivrei tzadikim, they also intercede on our behalf. Or the possibility is that since these are places where the tzadikim are buried, and Jews always visit those areas, the areas become makomot of tefillah. They become places where people daven. And so almost in a circular logic, then if people always go to their daven, so then when we go to daven there, it's special or unique. But it's not brought by any of the Rishonim over here, as to the fact that he was delineating or marking the kivrei tzadikim for the ability to daven over there. Now, the Rishbam adds a dimension over here and says, Rabbi Banah, Adam Gadol v'chashuv haya. He was a great man, very important. Lefikach nitan lo rishut likines bit kivrei tzadikim. So therefore, he was allowed to go into the kivrei tzadikim, whether that means permitted, period, or does that mean that because of the kdusha of those places, people couldn't get in there, but he had access to it? And again, you need access to the inside in order to delineate the space above. But that would indicate that Rabbi Manoah was, first of all, searching for the kivrei tzadikim, but beyond that, he was the uniquely qualified to go into these places because of his standing or his chashivut. So that might be another reason, not to do with tumah, but simply that he was finding the kivrei tzadikim and he had this unique capability of entering into those areas. And therefore, that's why he was the one going around and marking the graves. So, kimata de ma'arto de Abraham. When he reached the cave of Abraham, which is Marata Machpelah. Ashkeche le Eliezer Eved Abraham de Koyit Kamei Bava. He saw Eliezer guarding the doorway, guarding the entrance to the cave. Amalei, Micah Avid Avram, says, what's Avram doing inside? Now, the way that the Marsha says the question he's posing is, he has certain expectations about what Avram Avinu is doing, and he doesn't necessarily want to interrupt Avram Avinu, and that's why he assumes that Eliezer is at the doorway. Eliezer is guarding the doorway so that you don't disturb Avraham. And the Marsha suggests that either he thought that Avram Avinu was davening, because the avot daven, when we're in galut, they daven for our well-being or for our welfare, and therefore, he didn't want to bother him. Or, the possibilities we're going to see in a second, that Avram Avinu was possibly engaged in something that was private, and therefore, Eliezer was there to block the entrance of individuals. And that's what he asks Eliezer, what's Avram doing right now? Because you're blocking my access to the cave. So he says, Amalei, Gani bikantfo de Sarah. He is resting in the cloak or the arm of Sarah, become aina le bereshe, and she is looking at his head or checking his hair. As the Marsha points out over here, that was a practice of someone that was beloved, that you would look at into their head while they were sleeping. He notes the story that we saw by Rabbi Lazar by Rabbi Shimon by Yochai's son, in Bava Metzia, where after he had passed away, he was up in the attic, and his wife used to come to visit him up there and look into his head or see his hair. He says it was a sign of affection and closeness. So that's what's going on over here. So then he says, Amale, he says to Eliezer, go tell Avram, Zil Emale Bna Koya Bava. Bna is at the door. So he wants to go in, but he's afraid of now interrupting their privacy, or it's niyut, whatever's happening over there. And so he asks Eliezer to inform Avraham that there's a guest here, they're coming to see him. Amale, Leol, go in. Miyadia de Yetzer by Amaleka. Says you don't have to worry about anything untoward happening over here, because there's no Yetzer Hara in that world, and therefore there's nothing going on there that's going to be private that you need to worry about. So here, these are the two worries of Rabbi Bana, that either he's engaged in tefillah, or that he's engaged in something of a private matter, and Eliezer waves him through. So the conclusion is that Eliezer is there to stop people who are inappropriate, people who shouldn't be entering into the Ma'arah. That's where Eliezer is there, and that goes back to the explanation of the Rashbam, that only someone who was a gadol v'chashuv could enter into the Kivrei Tzadikim. And so Eliezer was there to stop them, and he waves Rabbi Bana through, because obviously Rabbi Bana is of the stature or chashuv that he can enter. Aside from the beautiful romantic imagery of Avram and Sarah together in the Marat HaMachpelah, there's obviously a deeper meaning here. The Maral Kedarko Bakodesh speaks about the man and the woman contributing different factors. The man is the tzura, and the woman is the chomer, and the man brings tzura to the chomer of the woman. And through that, he explains the unity of a couple, of a male and a female. And so it's over here, the shleimut adam is only when they're together with their spouse. And so, again, aside from the romantic imagery, there's also another beautiful aspect here of this idea that the olam de'ate, in the world to come, the shleimut is only with the couple together. I mean, the two parts, or the two contributors to the family structure, the mother and the father, the husband and the wife, together they reach the point of shleimut, and this idea that they are united, even in the death, is indication of that closeness or that necessity to be mashlim echad et hasheni. Now, many of the Rishonim point out over here that none of this really happened. It was either all a dream or an experience for Rabbi Bana, but not that literally Avram and Sarah there, that Eliezer is there. It's all derech mashal or derech agadata to explain to us deeper ideas or concept. There's also another aspect of this, I just bring it in as an aside, but there is a Kabbalistic idea that when one passes away, they pass away and they leave through the entrance to Marat HaMachpelah. And that there's some concept, at least, that when the neshama leaves the guf of the Adam, that its exit from this world is derech through Marat HaMachpelah, which also might explain some of the significance of what is being said over here. So Ayin, so he went into the cave to check it out, v'nofak, and then he went out, kimata l'marto d'Adam HaRishon. When he reached the cave of Adam HaRishon, yatz the bat call, heavenly voice came out, v'amra, nistakalta bidmut diyukni, you looked at those that are made in my image, bidiyunki atzma al tistakel, but with the image itself, do not look. There is an indication here that Rabbi Bana no longer has permission to go on. We'll see from the upcoming Gemara that Marat HaMachpelah, machloket within the Gemara as to whether Marat HaMachpelah, the doubling of the Mara, was that they were two Me'arot, one on top of each other. There was an upper Me'ara and a lower Me'ara. Or were they side by side? There was an outer Me'ara and an inner Me'ara. What it seems from here is that the Avot were buried in the outer Me'ara, and an Adam HaRishon was buried in the inner Me'ara. And so that's why Rabbi Bana bumped into Avraham when he went into the outer Me'ara or the upper Me'ara, and then he demarcated or delineated that Me'ara, and now he wants to go to the inner Me'ara in order to see what the size is and to measure it out. And there he gets this heavenly voice coming and saying that you saw. There's two different interpretations over here. The Rashbam says, you looked at Dmut Diokni is Yaakov Avinu. You already looked at Yaakov Avinu, which the Gemara in a second is going to say that Yaakov Avinu was Me'ein Adam HaRishon. And so what he's saying to him is that you looked at Yaakov Avinu, that's enough. You don't have permission to see or to look at Adam HaRishon. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom over here says, "B'diyuk d'rokni is demuto shel Avram, kidmut Adam HaRishon." That you saw Avram Avinu already, that you had permission to do, to see Adam HaRishon, you do not have permission. We find this in a number of places, this is not unique here, where there's a question as to whether the Pasuk or the Chazal is speaking about Avraham or Yaakov. For instance, here is an example where it says, Dmut Diokni, my image, or the one in my image, is now referencing either Yaakov or Avraham. Another place that we have it is actually in the Seder and the Haggadah, where we have Arami Oved Avi. Depending on how you translate the Arami Oved Avi, it could be either referring to Yaakov Avinu. That's the way the Baal HaGadah interpreted it. But also could be, if you interpret it or you explain it a different way, it could be Avram Avinu. Similarly, in the Gemara in Shabbat, with regards to the Birkat HaMilah, with the bracha that you make on a Brit Milah, over there also, the Nusach HaBrocha, there's a machloket in the Rishonim as to whether the Nusach the Bracha is referencing to Avram Avinu or Yaakov Avinu. So we find this in a number of places, that Avram and Yaakov, it's unclear as to whether the reference is to Avram or Yaakov, and it would make sense because Avram and Yaakov have very, very similar experiences, and in a sense, they go through or live a very similar life. Yaakov Avinu is obviously on a much more detailed level, but their experiences and the nature of their interactions with God are very similar. And therefore, Avram and Yaakov, in a sense, are very similar as avot versus Yitzchak, who is very different from Avram and Yaakov. But here we have this possibility of either one of them. The point being that you've seen the image that is similar to Adam HaRishon, but Adam HaRishon, who is the purest or the closest to God, because he was B'Tselem Elokim, he's created in the image of God, and since he is the first man in the image of God, he's going to be the one that's closest to the image of God. And given that, you don't have permission, you're not allowed to look at them. So Rabbi Benoah, like a good worker, says, but Habina Litsune Marta, need to do my job. I have to demarcate, delineate the cave. I gotta go in there. Okay, I understand that you don't want me to, but what do you want me to do? Kemidat achitzona, karch midat apnimit. So the heavenly voice says to him, the outer cave and the inner cave are the same size. Or in essence, the inner cave you don't need to measure, because whatever you measure is for the outer cave, the same is true of the inner cave. That they were one on top of the other. The same measurement or internal dimensions of the upper cave are similar to the lower cave. So it's not going to be wider than that. If you delineate the upper cave, you will also capture the lower cave in that way. So Rabbi Benoah does not need to enter into there to see Adam HaRishon, because they give him the information without him having to enter. Amar Rabbi Benoah, Nistakalti b'shnei ekevav. I looked at his two heels, or his ankles, v'domim l'shnei galgalei achama. And they look like two balls of the sun. As you can see in the Rashbam, he says, b'shnei ekevav shel Adam HaRishon. That I peered into, I looked at the two heels or ankles of Adam HaRishon, and they look like two balls of the sun. What he is suggesting or saying over here is that the part of Adam HaRishon, the lowest piece, the part that he walks on and stomps on, which is not considered to be the most beautiful part of a person, it's not significant, yet it was so bright, or it's the beauty or the countenance of Adam HaRishon was so great, that even at his heels, it looked like I was looking into the balls of the sun, meaning that the perfection of Adam HaRishon, the beauty of Adam HaRishon, the fact that he is a Tzelem Elokim, is manifest in seeing his feet or his heels, them shining like the sun. Right, so then the Gemara continues with this and says, Hakol bifnei Sarah, kekof bifnei Adam. If one was to look at Sarah Imenu, the beauty of Sarah Imenu was so great that her beauty versus anyone else be the equivalent of a monkey compared to a person. So think about an ape, a monkey, something or primate that has similar features to a human being, but despite the similarities, nobody would say that a monkey or an ape looks like a human being or has the beauty of a human being. And so too, Sarah Imenu was so distinct in her beauty that there was nobody on her level. It wasn't even a fair comparison. Sarah bifnei Chava kekof bifnei Adam. That similarly is true in the comparison of Sarah to Chava, which is that the beauty of Sarah paled compared to the beauty of Chava, the way that a monkey would be differentiated from a human being. Chava bifnei Adam, and Chava's beauty, relationship to Adam, kekof bifnei Adam, similarly has the relationship of a monkey to a man, and Adam bifnei Shekhinah, and man, in comparison to the Shekhinah, to the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kekof bifnei Adam. So what you see here is a description of the beauty of the individual, whether we're talking about physical beauty, or whether we're talking about the beauty of the nefesh, or the neshama of the individual. What you clearly have here is, as you distance your way away from the Kodesh Baruch Hu, that diminishes. So Adam HaRishon, who is the creation, the handiwork of God, so his beauty is the closest to the purity and to the greatness of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and therefore Adam HaRishon has that unique standing. Chava, who's a derivative of Adam, already is a step down from Adam. And then Sarah Imenu, who is the mother of our nation, she was a step down from Chava. But each of them was on unique standing. And again, both maybe physically and spiritually. But as you moved away from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, or from the source, that diminishes because you've lost a certain amount of purity. You've lost a certain amount of connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the direct connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shufrei de Rav Kahana, beauty of Rav Kahana, Me'ein Shufrei de Rabbi Abo, was a percentage or a small derivative of the beauty of Rabbi Abo. Shufrei de Rabbi Abo, Me'ein Shufrei de Yaakov Avinu, the beauty of Rabbi Abo was from or a percentage, a derivative of the beauty of Yaakov Avinu. Shufrei de Yaakov Avinu, Me'ein Shufrei de Adam HaRishon. And the beauty of Yaakov Avinu was a derivative or a percentage of the beauty of Adam HaRishon. And that's why the Rashbam before said that you already saw Yaakov, you don't need to see Adam HaRishon, or you got a feeling already when you saw Yaakov. Now over here, the Gemara, when it talks about the beauty of an individual, it has two areas of beauty that it speaks about. One of them is the, what's called the Klaster Panim, which is the form or shape of the face. The other one is what we call the ziv, the radiance or countenance of the individual's appearance. And that's what it says by Rachel Imenu, that when it says Rachel was both a yifat toar v'yifat mar'eh, so yifat toar is the shape or form of the face, and yifat mar'eh is the appearance, the countenance, the radiance of the face. And so the Gemara, we saw this listing actually back in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, in Daf Pei Dalid. The Gemara in Bava Metzia says, what about Rabbi Yochanan? The beauty of Rabbi Yochanan is mentioned both in Bava Metzia, is mentioned in Brachot as well. How come he's not amongst the list of individuals that are here? And also, what happened to Sarai Imenu in this list? How come she's not mentioned over here? So the Marsha points out, but the Gemara itself in Bava Metzia notes this, the Rashbam over here quotes that. It says, "Basocher the polim parich lichshov nami Rabbi Yochanan, mshanim hadarat panim lohavile." He didn't have hadarat panim. So, whether that means he didn't have the countenance or radiance, or that means that he didn't have the shape or the form like these, but what the Marsha is pointing out is that the lists of beauty over here might be two different focuses in terms of the beauty that we're speaking about here. One list might be speaking about the form or the shape of the face and that beauty. The other one might be talking about the radiance and the countenance. And that's why you have Sarah in one list, not mentioned in the other list, as well as Chava. Whereas over here, the list is dealing with the other item, and he proves that from what the Gemara in Bava Metzia says, that Rabbi Yochanan, even though he was known to be a beautiful individual, he's not included in the list because he doesn't have the feature that this list was focused on. So given the fact that there are different aspects of beauty, or different facets of beauty, the list, when it's giving you that these individuals had that beauty that was a derivative of the other, it might be that it's focusing on one of those aspects of beauty and not both aspects of the beauty, and that's how you could have different lists or different enumerations of beauty. Obviously, that again, the shufrei, taken on a literal level, just means the beauty, but on a figurative level, it might also reference to not only the physical beauty, but to the spiritual beauty of these individuals. So now the Gemara continues with stories of Rabbi Bina. Hamgusha davachatet shachve. There was this sorcerer, magician in Bavel that was digging up the dead. Now, it seems like he's digging up the debt because of his profession, that he was an individual who was a magician, sorcerer, and he used the dead or the bones of the dead to perform whatever his activity was. But the Rashbam over here suggests that he was digging up the dead to take their clothing, which would make him more along the lines of a grave robber. Others suggest that the two are connected, that he took the clothing of the mitim in order to perform his sorcery, because that was a part of his sorcery. He didn't need the bones, he needed the clothing of the mitim. It also might relate to what we saw the Gemara Yevamot describe about Shibo Chavrei Le Bavel. When the Chavrei came to Bavel, which was a period of time where there was a change in the rulership over Bavel, and the change in rulership also brought around a different emphasis on the religious practices. And one of those practices was the practices of the Chavrei, which we see the Gemara speak about on a number of occasions were dangerous for the Jews. One of the reasons that they lit Hanukkah candles inside was because of this issue of the fire. They believed in the fire god. They were actually into dualism, light and darkness, and the practice that's still extant among some of the sects in Persia, Iran today, Zoroastrianism, that's still practiced today by the Yazidis. So they were involved in this, and the Chavrei were also known to dig up the dead. That's what they send over to Rabbi Yochanan, finds out that the Chavrei are in Bavel digging up the dead, and the Gemara over there speaks about why that was, what's the Midah Keneged Midah associated with that. But this might be connected to that as well, that they were digging up the dead. Kimata Amarto Deravtuvi Barmatna. So here, I'm sorry, this individual, this Amgusha, may not have been doing it on an institutional basis. He might have been doing it individually before it became popular, before the Chavrei rose to power and then were endorsed by the government. So Kimata Amarto Deravtuvi Barmatna. So he came onto the cave or the burial place of Ravtuvi Barmatna. So he's going to either disturb him, plunder, whatever he's doing over there. Tafse Bidikne, Tuvi Ramatna grabbed him by his beard and wouldn't let him go. Ata Abaye, Abaye seemingly was a friend or was good standing with this Amgusha. Amalei Matumi Nach, Shavke, look, do me a favor, Rav Tuvi Ramatna, let him go. Let him go this time. He learned his lesson. Obviously he didn't. Shana Achrite, the next year, Hadar Afte Tafse Bidikne, he tried it again the next year and he grabbed him by his beard. Ata Abaye, so Abaye came back again to try to help him out of the bind. Lo Shavke, Rav Tuvi Ramatna wouldn't let him go. Aite Mispira, Vigazia Ledikne, till they brought in scissors and cut off his beard. And that was the only way they could release him from the situation. Again, he didn't learn his lesson the first time. So the second time, he didn't get let go or released so easily. And the idea being that he should have already realized that what he was doing was incorrect and not repeated the sin or infraction. And when he does repeat it, the punishment is more severe. There was this individual who said, Chavita de Afra de Chadbrai, one barrel of dirt, earth to my child. Chavita de Garmi de Chadbrai, a barrel full of bones to my other child. And then the last one, Chavita de Udra de Chadbrai. And then one barrel of feathers or soft pieces of wool to my other child. Lo havi yadei, my gamarluhu. Nobody knew what this individual was saying. He's saying this on his deathbed. He's giving his last will and testament. And he talks about these three barrels being given to his three different sons. The way that the Rashbam describes it over here was he was a wealthy individual. And he didn't want people to know about his wealth. And so therefore he passed the wealth to his children in this cryptic manner so that nobody would know about the assets of the estate. The Marsha says that he doesn't think that's a great explanation. Only because it's going to actually lead to just the opposite. If he gives it in a cryptic manner, then they're going to have to go to court. They're going to have to go disclose the information for someone to explain to them or to decipher what he was saying, and it's going to actually make it more public rather than less public. So the Marsha suggests that the reason was that he wasn't sure if he was going to pass away. He's on his deathbed, but he's just uncertain as to whether he would pass away or not. And so therefore he gave it in a cryptic manner so the children themselves would not understand necessarily what they were being given. That way, if he survived, and then he would rescind the gifts, the children would not be jealous, or would not really know what type of bias he had had in giving the gifts to the different children, and things would go on as normal, without having any of the implications of what's been written in, or given in his last will and testament. So that's why he did it in this cryptic manner, so as not to offend anyone, and they would only get the information after he had passed away, because then they'd have to ask or get interpretation of the information. So then they went to get this deciphered. Atu lekamei d'Rabbi Bana. They came before Rabbi Bana. Amar lehu, itluchu ara. Says, does your father have property? Amar le'in. He says, itle chevata. Does he have animals? Amar le'in. They said to him, yes. Itluchu bistarke. Does he have clothing? Or does he have pieces of clothing? In, they said to him, yes. Ihachi, if that's the case, hachi kamar luhu. This is what he meant to tell you. Which means that if now we associate each one of the barrels with one of the assets of the estate, which is the barrel full of earth or dirt, that was referencing to the karka, that was referring to the assets. The barrel full of bones was referencing to the animals, because the animals are used for their meat and for the bones. So the animals were referenced by the barrel of bones. The barrel of udra, of feathers, according to the Rabbeinu Gershom, the barrel full of pieces of wool, soft items, that was referencing to the bigadim. That's the way that the Rashbam reads it over here, that it was bustarki ar kol minei bigadim asuyim imuchin. It's all different pieces of clothing that are made out of these pieces or loose pieces of wool. The other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom says it's karim v'kistot imitzaot. It was pillows, comforters, beds, mattresses, asum mi'udrin, that are made out of either feathers or muchin, which are these pieces of wool. So that was something more metaltalim oriented, but that's what he was gifting to his children, and Rabbi Bana was able to decipher what he had meant. Hau gavra, deshama ledebitu, this individual overheard his wife saying, dekamar lebrata, she was saying to her daughter, amai lo tzniat bi'isura, says, why aren't you being careful in your promiscuous behavior? Obviously, the daughter was sleeping with multiple men, but the news or the information was getting out there, and her mother is chastising her and saying, why don't you do this in a much more private way? If you're going to engage in this behavior, at least make sure that nobody knows about it. And I'll tell you why. Hachitata, me? Asra bani itla. I have 10 children. Lately me'avu chelachad. And only one of them is the child of your father. So the mother herself had been involved in many illicit relationships. All of her children were mamzerim, with the exclusion of one, which was born to the father of this girl, or to her husband. So the father or the husband is overhearing this conversation. Kishachi, when he passed away, amalu kol nechsai lechad bro, says, all my possessions go to one child. So obviously nobody knew what he was talking about, or as to which one of the children that was. He was reacting to the information that he had gleaned from overhearing the conversation of his wife, which is that only one of the children was really his child. So he left all the assets to that child, but nobody knows this information. So how did he know when he said, leave it to one child? They didn't know which one to give it to. After the came to Rabbi Bana, so they came to Rabbi Bana to help have him help them understand what's going on. Amalo, he said to them, zilu chavutu kavra d'avuchom. Go and bang on your father's grave. Until he gets up, until he rises from the dead and tells you or informs you as to which one of the children he left his estate. Azlu kulu, they all went to the gravesite. Hal debre hava loazon, the one that was his real son, meaning that he was his biological son, he did not go to the grave. Amalu kulu nechsei dehai. All of the possessions belong to this individual. According to Rashbam, this was like a Solomonic type of decision, what he does with the two zonot and the baby. He says that mamzerim are azepanim. They're individuals who are brazen, who are not respectful of other individuals. So only someone with that type of nature would go bang on their father's kever, which is an inappropriate type of behavior. And therefore, the one who didn't go was clearly not a mamzer, and the others were mamzerim. That's the way the Rashbam describes it over here. Others suggest that it had nothing to do with the Solomonic type of decision-making, but rather, as the Rashbam notes over here, that v'yafed dan Rabbi Bana, Rabbi Bana did the right thing here, d'lo shayachach ala shudah d'dayne. In the end, it's up to the dayan to decide what to do with the possessions. Here you have something that's cryptic, unintelligible, and the dayan has to make a decision. The facts of the case are not going to give him the information that he needs in order to make the decision. Therefore, it's left up to what's called shudah d'dayne. So shudah d'dayne, we saw actually earlier here, we saw in Bava Metzia, it's Machloket Rashi and Tosafot, as to what the Shuddha Dadaini means. Rashi says that Shuddha Dadaini means that it's whatever the Dayan determines based on the facts. He'll have to go with his intuition about who the right recipient is over here. The Tosafot brings proof to the fact that he thinks that's wrong, and that Shuddha Dadaini means whoever the judge decides, period. It can be random, it can be by lottery, it can be whatever, whoever he favors. Whatever it is, he can make the decision. Over here, the way the Rashbam is explaining it, it would favor Rashi's interpretation, which is the Shuddha Dadaini over here is that the Dayan has to make a decision as to what is the most appropriate outcome over here based on the information that he has. So either the test, according to the Rashbam, was these were Mamzerim, therefore they acted in a manner that was of Azut Panim, and they went and banged on their father's, or their so-called father's grave, and therefore the one who didn't go was indicative of the fact that he was the child. Or it might be just the opposite way around, which is he was looking for the most appropriate child to give it to, and therefore the child who behaved in this manner was the most appropriate. Doesn't mean that he was the child, but the test was to see which of these children the father would have meant, or which of them has midot, or a character that would have had his father favor that child. And therefore he saw from the activities undertaken here that the one child who didn't go was probably the child the father referenced to because of his behavior, his good midot, or the way that he acted. So whether it's, again, a solution to the problem and figuring out which one is the biological child, or whether it's simply trying to ascertain what we thought the father would have meant, and this was a way to test that, either way, Rabbi Benoah came to the conclusion that this individual was the deserving party. Azlu achlu kurtza be malka. It's a terminology that's used in the Gemara in a number of places. Kurtza is described in other places as either being breaking bread, but it really involves breaking bread and then winking, but it's a way to engage in basically tattletaling or speaking to the authorities about someone that you want to turn into the authorities. But it's done in this not less direct manner. It's done in whether this was the etiquette or the way that it was done, or whether this was a way to do it in a underhanded manner and not directly. Achlu be kurtza means that they basically went and told the governors or the ruling government officials about this. Amrei ika gavra chad biyudai. There's this individual amongst the Jews, the kamapik mamon ma'anshe below sadeh. He is removing money, extorting money from people without any witnesses, or below raya, and without any proof. And he's doing it based on his intuition. He is judging cases, which makes him sound like he is some charlatan that's running this court, and he's making decisions, shooting from his hip, and not making decisions that are based on witnesses, evidence, and so on and so forth. So the individual, the children who got disinherited based on Rabbi Benoah's decision, they got upset. So they go to the government and say that he's making these indiscriminate decisions. You got to arrest him for behaving in this manner. So sure enough, that's what they did. They brought him chavshu, and they incarcerated him. Azla debitu, his wife, meaning Rabbi Benoah's wife, comes to plead to the authorities. Amro lehu, she says to them, Abdachad Havali, I had this one slave or servant. Pasku the reshe, they cut off his head. Upashtu the mashche, and then they skinned him. Vachu bisre, they ate his flesh. Vekalu malu be mayo, and then they filled it up with water, the skin. Umashke be the chavraya, and then they're giving it to the chavirim and the Beit Midrash to drink. Veloka yahavili dame, and they're not giving me any money. Velo agre, and not the, whether it's a reward or sachar, the rent, the income from this. Veloyadai, my amrlahu. They had no idea what she was saying. She's definitely speaking in a way of a parable, but they couldn't make heads or tails out of this woman who's making the plea. Now, it's obviously a ploy over here because this is Rabbi Benoah's wife. And so she's giving them a riddle that they're not going to be able to decipher. And therefore, amrei netu lechakima diyudai. Let's bring a wise person from the Udai, from the Jews, in order to interpret this. Velema, and he'll tell us what it means. So Karyu, the Rabbi Benoah. So sure enough, they called Rabbi Benoah to interpret it. Amaluhu. So he said to them, Zarnoka Amaluhu. She's telling you that this is a flask. This is a canteen that is made out of skin. And the way that the Rashbam explains it over here was that she had this animal, a tayish, that was stolen. And then it was stolen, they shechted it, they cut it up, and then they made the skin into a flask or a canteen. And then they were drawing water or drinking water with that. So here was this impoverished woman who the thieves were taking advantage of. And that was the explanation of what's being said over here. To Amre, ho b'chakim kulei hai, since you are so wise, leite abovav nidondina, say by the doorway or by the sharim, the entranceway to the city or whatever area they're in, and you should adjudicate over there. That's where they used to have the judgments, right? We see that in Sefer Breishit and by Boaz in Megillat Rut, that they would go by the Shar Ha'ir. That's where they did all this type of judging, also by Ephron and Abraham. All these things were done at the entrance to the city. So they put him there to adjudicate and become a judge at the entrance to the city. Now, what is meant by the Mashal? Again, the Rashbam over here seems to indicate it was simply a ploy to have them be perplexed by this woman, and then they would have to call in Rabbi Benah in order to solve the problem. The Mashal wants to explain it in a deeper way, or as a Mashal, and again, he struggles with it a little bit, but then he says that what she was saying is that you took away Rabbi Benah, who was responsible for my sustenance. You took away my Eved, who was Eved, meaning he was in servitude, not because he was a slave, but he is obligated to provide mizonot for his wife. So you took away my breadwinner. You took away my husband, who is obligated to provide my mizonot. And you paskiyat reshei, you took off his head, meaning that you have now removed him from his position or his work, which was being a dayan. And we know that he was also a mitzayin marta. So now you took away his position or his means of making a living, which would provide it for me. And then you, achlul bisrei, because when they took him into incarceration, they imprisoned him, then they stripped him down and they take away your clothes, your possessions, which we find in other places that they used to do that. When you were taken in prison, you lost everything. I mean, even in the modern day, you get a prison garb. That's for different reasons. But over here, they take away all your possessions. So not only did you take away his ability to provide for me, you also stripped him down of all of his clothing and everything that he had. And so now there's nothing left for me. That's what it means, achla bisarei. And then they use the basar, or the skin, to fill up the water. She says that, ki gam betfisato abriot tzrichim lo, that not only do I need him, but other people need him, because his friends or others are learning Torah from him. And Torah is nimshal de mayim. So what she's saying is, not only did you take away the breadwinner from me and my family, you took away an individual who was teaching Torah, or providing sustenance, quote-unquote, to the remainder of Klal Yisrael, because he was a teacher, he was a Talmud Chocham. And that was the remez that she was bringing, is that you've taken away all of these items from me and from Klal Yisrael, and they didn't understand it. And that's what he came to explain, that she was talking about a flask of water, or in essence she was saying that you took away the provider, both the provider of Torah and my provider over here. And that's why she used this as the mashal in order to hint to them about what they had done to Rabbi Benah. So now they put Rabbi Benah in place. It seems that it was written on the top of the gateway. The avula is usually like the arch of the gateway. We see that in other places when they dig up archaeological digs, is that on the archway, that is by the shar, by the gateway on the entrance, they used to inscribe or write things on top. So here on this archway was written, likely it was written there because the court sat over there. It says, Kol Dayan, Demitgere Ledin, any Dayan, any judge that is brought to judgment, Lo Shmei Dayan, he is no longer qualified as a judge. Which means that if a judge is brought to court over claims or incriminating charges, then he's no longer valid or ra'oi to be a judge, in the position of a judge, because he's now suspect. He's suspect of stealing money. So then how could he be an impartial judge in other situations, because he's open to bribery and to other situations? Amalahu. So he said back to them, Elimiato. If that's the case, Atein Ishmeyama. Anybody who wants to could remove a judge from his position, because he could come and trump up charges against the judge. Umazmin lay the daina, and then he'll invite him to a court case, and paslate, and he'll no longer be valid as a dayan. So if all it takes to ruin the reputation or the standing of a judge is to bring him to court, anybody can bring a judge to court, because you can simply trump up charges and bring him to court. Ella, the Rabbi Benoah says, this is what you should say there. Kol dayan demitkere ledin. Any judge that is called to a case, umafkin mimei mamona, bedin, and then he's found guilty, And then they take money from him, meaning that he's made to pay. He's found guilty in the case, and they extricate money from him based on the judgment. Lav shmei dayan. Then he's not a dayan. So here, if the altercation results in a prosecution, then he should be disqualified as a judge. But simply to end up in a court case, that's not enough of a reason to disqualify the judge. First of all, Tosfot over here says that shouldn't, even Rabbi Benoah's case needs to be qualified, because he says if the individual has the option to take a shvuah to make himself patur, but he prefers not to take a shvuah, and therefore he pays in lieu of taking the shvuah, that's not an indication of guilt. That's simply a choice that he doesn't want to take a shvuah because of the fear of taking a shvuah. And therefore the Baal Tosfot would say over there that also would not disqualify him from being a judge. So in the end, what they did was katfu achi. So in the end, they wrote on, or they inscribed over there, biram. They put a qualifier to the previous statement. The previous statement said any judge that's brought to judgment is disqualified as being a judge. Biram, sabai the Yudai, the elder of the Jews, Amre, he says, kol dayan dimitkei ledin, umafki minei mamonu bedin. If he's called to a court case and then prosecuted, and then they extract money from him based on the finding that he was guilty, lav shmei dayan, then he's disqualified. Now, it might have been that this is a play between the two parties, that's the Marsha suggests over here, that they intentionally placed him there by the gateway where it said that, because they, despite his wisdom and his ability to adjudicate, and in some senses they were poking at him a little bit, which is that he was already brought and incarcerated. So they were saying that you should be disqualified as a judge. Despite your wisdom, you should not be qualified because you were already incarcerated and taken to judgment. And Rabbi Benoah's response to them is, they were trumped up charges. These kids that had been disinherited for a good reason were trumping up charges against me. Just because they trump up charges doesn't mean I should be disqualified. And so his response to them is, I'm not disqualified because nobody found me guilty. There's no evidence to indicate that I did anything wrong. So it might have been, again, a play here, the writing, whether there really were inscriptions, but it might be just a description in the pull between them as to whether he was really qualified or not qualified to be a judge. So now, Chaza, the tztiv, he saw also another inscription that was written. Barosh komota ano, I am the cause of all death, or I'm the leading cause of death. Dam, that is blood. Blood is the leading cause of all death. Barosh kochayin, and the head of all things that are living, meaning that things that cause a refuah, ano, I am chamar. I am wine. So the inscription basically said that everything bad that happens when people get sick and they die, it's because of blood. The way that the Rishpam explains it over here is that means that you have too much blood. You need to bloodlet. And since you haven't bloodlet, the excess of blood is what causes you to die. On the other hand, the drinking of wine is something that if it's done in proper amounts and proper times, is very healthy and will cause the person to live longer. So right now Rabbi Benoah challenges that. He says, "Ve'lemi'ata, d'nafal mi'igre umit, b'nafal mi'diklo umit, dama katle." What are you going to say now? Someone who falls off a roof, someone who falls out of a palm tree and dies, it was their blood that caused them to die? What does it have to do with their blood? It was the impact of falling that caused them to die. It has nothing to do with the excess blood. So how can you claim here that blood or excess blood is the primary cause of death? V'tu. And so also, when was the last time you saw somebody on his deathbed and you gave him wine to drink and all of a sudden he came back to life and everything went okay? We don't see wine being any potion of life either. So neither of the expressions that are written here or neither of these pitgamim that are inscribed makes sense, he says. Ella, hachi by the michtov. This is what needs to be written over here. Barosh ko mar'in ano dam. I am the cause of all, we'll call it, sickness or deterioration in a person's health. That is dam, that is blood. Barosh kol asvan ano chamar. The leading remedy out there that could help a person when they are sick is chamar. So neither of them are foolproof, but it's making a point is that sickness is related to the excess dam, and the cure or the best medicine is drinking wine in a proper measure and at proper times. That's what the Rashbam describes over here. So he amended the inscriptions or the common colloquialisms to make them make more sense rather than what was written there before. So therefore, afterwards, after Rabbi Ba'anah gave his note to their colloquialism, Katvuhachi, they added an inscription, Baram Sabed Yudai Amre, that the elder of the Jews says, Barosh Kol Marin Ana Dam, Barosh Kol Azvan Ana Chamar. They added in his qualifier to the statements that were there before. And here the Marsha describes, Nir Lomar, the fish Shinoi Katvo, Shalit Kaven Al Choli Aguf, Rak Al Choli Anefesh. He says that after Rabbi Benoit changed it, it seems here clearly that the reference is not to physical sickness, rather Choli Anefesh, to the, whether it's the spiritual sickness or the mental state of the individual. Shamar Barosh Komarin Shel Nefesh Ano, I am the primary cause for whether it's mental illness or for spiritual illness, dam. Kimo, kedam hua nefesh. That's what the Torah says all over the place. You're not allowed to eat the dam, not allowed to drink the dam, because the dam hua nefesh. That is the nefesh. Bahu, kiro midot ha-ra'ot, that the bad character of the individual, tluim beriboy adam, is connected to excess blood. And he gives examples. Kimo, hakas, vakina, anger. When you boil up in anger, you turn all red. So he says that he referred to it. Kina, and jealousy also. Visina, and hatred. Kiyotze bahem. Shame kulam choli anefesh, shame. They all are sicknesses of the soul, of the mental state of the individual. And that's caused by the ribui dam. Varmar barosh kol azvan. In terms of the leading cures, shehu refuat anefesh. Something that brings a cure to this mental illness or to the spiritual illness. Anachamra, that is wine, like it says, v'yayin yisamach l'bavenosh, that wine causes people to be happy, it raises their spirits. Zacha misamcho, if a person is zoche merits, then wine will help him, and if not, obviously it's the opposite, as well as the fact that the sodei Torah, yayin, nichnas yayin yatsa sod, which is brought in the Gemara and Erevin as well, which is that it increases the mental sharpness and capacity of the individual when they drink wine. And so therefore, Ikar Chachmat V'Soda Torah, Shinim Shel Aliyayin. That refers to the Torah, which is compared to wine. So whether it's literally wine, which means that it brings out the mental acuity of the individual is improved by the wine, or it means that this is a Mashal in Torah, that wine and Torah, and therefore the learning of Torah is the something that will help the individual. That's how the Marsha reads this, or it comes to explain the difference between the original statement and the statement of Rabbi Benah, that he's shifting the perspective from that of physical illness to the Chole HaNefesh, and that's why he alters the Pitgam in that manner. And then the Gemara says, Ba'atar Deleit Chamar, in a place where there is no wine, Taman Midbau Smanim. There they need lots of medicines. They need lots of medicinal cures, because without the wine, the people fall ill. They don't have the cure of the wine. Lacking the cure of the wine, they have to come up with other medicinal cures. And the way that the Marsha explains it is that simanim are the way that you remember the Torah. I mean that a person who wants to memorize or remember Torah Shebaal Peh, he uses simanim, or indications, in order to do that. So now the Gemara continues again on a non sequitur, but we'll understand the connection, which is, it's a similar type of concept to what's going on with Rabbi Benah. Teva pitcha de kaputkia. At the entrance to Kaputkia, it's written, Anpak, Anbeg, Antel. So that's what's written on the doorway or the archway going in there. Vezu Antel. And what is this Antel? Zeu Revit Shel Torah. That is the Revit of the Torah. So now, in terms of what's going on over here, the Rashbam suggests that these were three different measurements. They were different measurements that were known in different locations or different places. And what the signage on the top of the archway that was coming to teach you was that these are all synonymous in terms of their size. That is, an anpek, an anbeg, and an antel are our measurements. And those measurements are all similar. Then the Gemara asks, okay, now given that they are synonymous, what is the measurement that we're speaking about? And they say, well, the antel is a revi'it of the Torah, and therefore the revi'it of the Torah is the measurement for all of these three different names that are given. The Rashbam over here says it's called revi'it shel Torah, Mishum de arba kosot shel Pesach, minyan de yoma. It's the four cups of wine on Pesach. Shi'uran bi revi'it. Their requirement is that they be a revi'it yayin. Umatsu lehem chachamim smach min haTorah. And the chachamim found indications of this in the Torah. Midalek kosot amorim bi Mitzrayim. From the four kosot that are said by Mitzrayim, that's by the dreams of the baker and the butler, The word kos is mentioned four times there. The Midrash brings, that's a hint to the Arba Kosot, Midalad Lishonei Geula, and also from the four Lishonot of Geula Hamurim, Parshat Behotzeiti, in the beginning of Parshat Ve'era. Fika Karile Revi'et Shel Torah. That's why he calls it Revi'et Shel Torah. V'chein Revi'et Shel Yayin Nazir. And also, the Revi'et Yayin of a Nazir is Alacha L'moshe Mitzinai that we see in Masechet Nazir. And in Masechet Nazir, they enumerate 10 Revi'ot that are Min HaTorah. So that's this concept of why Revi'et is Min HaTorah. It's not just the shir of the Chachamim, but it relates to halachot that have connection to Torah laws, and therefore it's known as Revi'et Min HaTorah. That is the explanation of the Rashbam. The Rabbeinu Gershom already seems to pull away from that a little bit, and then the Baal Tosafot take it a step further. The Rabbeinu Gershom over here explains, Klomar, otokli asparagus, shishotim bishacharit. This drink of asparagus that they drink in the morning, mishum refuah, for medicinal purposes, hayukorin ota bilashonam anpek. They used to call it an anpek in their language. Vahainu anpek, vahainu antel. And it's synonymous with the anbeg and the antel. Klomar, shiro boto kli shnotlim mimenu yadayim. Antel comes from the word natla. Natla is used in the Gemara for a washing cup. So they're saying here that that cup that is used to drink this asparagus, which is described again in the Gemara in Brachot and other places as being a question of what bracha you make on it, as well as its medicinal purposes are mentioned in other places in the Gemara in Chulin. So putting all of that information together, what the Rabbeinu Gershom says is, they were describing this cup of medicine, and then they connected it to the anbeg and the antel, and the antel, which is a natla, is the cup that's used for washing yadayim, is a revi'it. So now you know how much of this medicine you should be drinking on a daily basis. That's the way the Rabbeinu Gershom does it. The Baal Tosafot take it one step further. He says, Omer Rabbeinu Chaim, the anbeg and the anpeg hem mashkim de refua. He says that the anbeg and the anpeg are medicinal drinks. V'hainu asparagus. And that is the asparagus that's mentioned in the Gemara in Chulim. And v'achi kamar hacha, mashikorin anbeg v'anpeg, tzirik l'shoto k'shiro shel antel, shel revit. You have to drink it at the size of an antel. So he says both of them are considered to be medicinal drinks, not compared to the antel at all, which is a measurement. So they're saying the phrase that is being written there is, these two wine or medicinal drinks should be drank in the shiur of an antel. So it's similar to Rabbeinu Gershom, but takes it one step further, saying both of the items in the beginning are refuah. The Rabbeinu Gershom seems to indicate that the anpek and the anbeg are either synonymous, or it's connecting it to the anbeg, which is connected to the antel. But either way, in the end, you come up with a measurement of a revi'it. The way that the Rashbam learns it is that these were all measures, and therefore it was giving you a way to know what the measures are. According to the Baal Tosafot and the Rabbeinu Gershom, these were medicines, and you wanted to know what was the proper quantity of the medicine to drink for it to be efficacious. Now we move on to the next Mishnah. The Mishnah is going back to the establishment of Chazakot. Once again, here you have the same dissonance in the Rishonim. The Rashbam continues along his opinion that all the Chazakot that we're speaking about here are for 3 years. It's establishing chazakah because of usage for 3 years. Others are using it more along the lines of adverse possession, which is that these are items that people object to immediately. If someone doesn't object, then you gain the right to continue to use it in this manner. Again, whether that's immediate or up to 30 days, whatever the time period you think it is, but it's another mechanism of adverse possession, but it's not referencing the 3 years that we've been using throughout the perek. Hamar zev ein lo chazakah. The Marzev does not have a chazakah, but its location has a chazakah. The Gemara will discuss that. I'm not going to go into details in the Mishnah. What's the difference between the Marzev itself and its placement? But Mazchila, yesh lo chazakah. On the other hand, the Mazchila has a chazakah. What we're speaking about here are the gutters. The gutters that take the water off the roof. The gutter, which is the runners that go along the roof, that's called the Mazchila. The Marzev is the leads that come off the gutters that take the water from the runners and to take the water away from the roof and deposit it somewhere. Marzev would be the leader, and the Mazchila would be the gutter. In their day, it's not exactly like that we have it today, where the gutters take it all the way down to the ground and spill it out on the ground. The leads in their day took a pipe that came off the gutter and just was stopped over there and shot the water wherever it went from there, but moved it away from the house itself. So what the Mishnah is saying is that the marzev, the lead, does not have a chazakah, even though its location has a chazakah. The maschila defin has a chazakah. The distinction that the Rashbam draws, and that will be, it's made clear in the Gemara as well, is that it depends on its nature of its permanence. A gutter is something, the gutter or the runners that you have along the roof, those are permanent. You put them up there, you don't move them anymore. Since you don't move them, they gain you the chazakah, because if you put them there, the person knows when you put them there, you're not moving them again. Then the maschila, which is the lead, people move them. We'll see in the Gemara what that means. What does it mean they turn the direction, or whether they actually change where the lead is off of the gutter? Those are things that are not permanent. So the lack of objection by something that's not permanent is not an indication of acquiescence, because they're not objecting because it's something they know that you could move or it's temporary. Something that's of a permanent nature, if they don't object, that's acquiescence. And so that's the difference between the gutter and the leads. Sulama mitzri eno chazaka. The Egyptian ladder, which was a lighter, more mobile type of ladder, that doesn't have a chazaka. So if he puts it in your chatzer in order to get to his roof, the placement of the ladder there and its being there does not grant him the right of chazaka, because it's a temporary type of ladder. It's like bringing up a ladder that you open up and you're climbing onto the roof. Nobody thinks that you're establishing chazaka there. They assume you're going to move the ladder after you finish doing your work. Ulitzuri yesh lo chazaka. On the other hand, the ladders from Tyre, they do have a chazaka, because they were much more hefty, permanent types of ladders. You have to remember in their day that staircases were also known as sulamot. They were also known as ladders. And so therefore, if you're putting in a sulam tsuri, it's as if you're putting in a staircase. It's something that's going to be there permanently. It's not something that person's planning on moving very soon. So there, if you don't object, he does establish a chazaka, or the right to maintain it there. Chalona mitzrit ein la chazaka. An Egyptian window doesn't have a chazaka. Ulitzurit yesh lo chazaka. So the same distinction over here, which is that the Egyptian one is more temporary, and the one from Tyre is more permanent. It's interesting, I don't know if in Egypt, the nature of the building or the nature of their items, whether they built on a smaller scale or they were building from mud instead of from stone, and therefore the Mitzri things are less permanent versus the things from Tyre, which are more permanent. The nature of the difference is, Ezoi Chalon Mitzrit. What is determining? How do you know whether it's an Egyptian window or a Tyre window? Kol Shein Roshosho Shel Adam Yecholi Kanes L'Tocha. If your head can't fit into the window, that is considered to be an Egyptian window. Over here, the Rashbam comes to describe this and says that the difference has to do with Chalon Mitzrit Ketanahu. Im Asa Chalon Bakoto Beito Labit Derech Sham Lishmor Pardeso Beginato. So you opened up a small opening in the house, because in that direction are your fields or your gardens, and you want to be able to peek out and see them at all times, so you don't have to go out there all the time. You have this little window. So there, that is opened up through the chatzer of his friends. So you can establish a chazaka if it's a permanent window. But if the window is so small that you're just peering out of it, that's not considered to be kviut, because you can always close it up. It's just a small opening. On the other hand, if he opens up a window for light, that is considered to be a permanent structure or something that he's not going to close up. Or on the other way around, if you build something opposite that window and block the light, he's going to object. So therefore, you need to object to him opening up the window, because he's going to then impinge on your rights going forward of blocking the light to his house. So that's the way that the Rashbam explains the difference. But the idea in general is the difference between something that's temporary versus something that is permanent. Or the other possibility is this idea of chezek riyah, which again, if you look through a window that is smaller, you can't fit your head into it, there's very little hezek riyah, because you can't get peripheral views through the window. You can only see directly through that small hole. A larger window gives you the ability to see along the periphery, and therefore there's a much greater problem of hezek riyah. So whatever the reason is, one of them is considered to be temporary or less problematic, and therefore you don't need to object. The other one, which is much more permanent or problematic, if you don't object, then you're granting that person the chazakah, or it's as if they can make a claim that they have permission to do it because you did not object to them putting it in. Rav Yehuda Omer, Emeshla Malbein, if it has a frame around it, Apopi Shein Rosh Shoshal Adam Yecholi Kanes L'Tochar Yizu Chazaka. If you put a frame around the window, even though it's so small that you can't get your head out of it, that still will establish a chazaka, and it makes sense, because the whole idea is that if you're framing out the window, you're not planning on taking this out anymore. You're not removing it. It becomes much more of a permanent structure. versus something that is not framed, it's just a hole in the wall that you would expect the guy to plug up at some point, and therefore would not be permanent. Gemara asks, "May hamarzev ein lo chazaka, v'ish lemkomo chazaka." What does it mean that the lead off the gutter does not have a chazaka, but its location has a chazaka? Am Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Hachin Kamar. This is what is meant. Hamarzev ein lo chazaka miruach achat does not have a chazaka from one side. V'ish lemkomo chazaka mishtei ruchot. But it does on its location have a chazaka from two sides. So now, the way that the Rashbam explains it over here is, if the marzev is on one end of the gutter, and it's been there for 3 years pouring out water, if the Bala Chatzir needs that area, and he wants you to move the lead, and to put it on the other side of the gutter, then the Balagag, the owner of the roof, or the upper part where he has the gutter, is not going to lose out from that. And so therefore, Ein kan kviut liot munach lolamim l'ruach zeh. He does not have a right to maintain it in that particular direction. What it is basically, the individual has a right to have a lead come off the gutter. Where that lead is along the gutter, there he does not have a chazaka for it. And that's why the Bala Chatzir did not object to him having the lead on that side or one side of the gutter, because he can move it to the other side of the gutter. He can demand that he moves it to the other side of the gutter. So what the balance is according to Shmuel is that the lead off the gutter, you have a right to have. But the Bala Chatzir has the right to determine which side of the gutter you put the lead on. So that means that the lead itself does not establish a chazaka as to its placement, but you do have a chazaka that you have a right to have a lead come off this gutter. Just a Bala Chatzir can tell you which side of the gutter to put it on. And that way, both parties are fine. The Bala Chatzir can determine where the water goes in his chatzir, and the Bala Gag always has what he needs, which is getting the water away from the house, away from the roof. That will be done. It just depends on the location along the gutter where you have to place it. That's the way the Rashbam learns. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot say, I don't understand that explanation because of the Tema. The problem with that is that if you say that the Marzev does not have a chazaka, but the mazchila does have a chazaka, the gutter itself or the runners have a chazaka, but the leads coming off of them do not have a chazaka, that means that he can demand, like the Rashbam is saying, that you move the lead to the other side of the gutter. Well, the gutter has to flow in a direction. It means that you have to tilt the gutter towards whichever lead you want it to drain from. So that means that if you have the option to force him to move the lead from one side to the other side of the gutter, that means that you're going to have to move the gutter itself. Then that changes what we said in the Mishnah. We said in the Mishnah, the mazchila, the gutter itself, or the runners, do establish a chazaka because they are permanent. You don't move them. But I said, what do you mean you don't move them? If you could change where the lead is, that means you're going to also have to tilt the mazchila to another direction. That means they do move. Why does that establish a chazaka then? It says, v'yesh lomar, t'milchom kom yesh lo chazaka, shein tzarich lo kra de gamre mim koma. It's different between totally removing the item and simply tilting it in a direction. The lead, you're going to have to take it off one end and move it to the other end. That's a real movement of the item. The fact that you have to tilt the gutter in one direction, the other direction, that's just an adjustment. That's not a change to the fact that it's going to be there permanently. I think Tosfot acknowledges that that's not so easy because changing the tilt of the mazchila is a pretty big undertaking. Inami kigon shemazchila shaveh. It's totally flat. The gutter is totally flat. Vein gvoa tzadzeh yoter mizeh. One side is not higher than the other. And then the only question is, where do you put the plug and where do you put the lead that comes out of it? So the gutter is flat, it'll fill up, and it'll drain out of one side, the side that is open. It won't drain out of the side that is closed. And therefore, that's why the mazchila is permanent, because you don't have to do anything with it. It remains there, and you don't have to move it at all. And then he brings the perush, Rav Rabbeinu Yosef perush. He brings an alternate explanation of the Rabbeinu Yosef, and he says, Ki inyan zeh perush Rabbeinu Chananel. And the Rabbeinu Chananel said something similar over here, which is that, Marzev she'en lo chazakam ruach achat. The fact that the marzev doesn't have a permanent or a chazaka for one direction, the lead that comes off of the gutter, you can turn it to face in different directions. So that's what it means. He doesn't have a chazaka from ruach achat. He doesn't have the right to determine where the lead pours the water out. Again, it's not like in our day where they take the gutters all the way down to the ground and then let the water out of the ground. They had a lead that came off a little bit off the gutter, and then it poured the water, shot the water in any direction. Certain places they still have that. today. So that's what it means. Meruach achat. What you have a right to over here is to the makom, where the lead is on the gutter, that you have a right to maintain, that you have a chazaka for. Where the lead pours out to in the chatzer, that you do not have a chazaka for. So the Baal HaChatzer can tell you, pour the water out this way or pour it out that way, but he can't make you move the lead from where it is along the gutter. That's the way the Rabbeinu Yosef explains it. As the Rabbeinu Chananel says, that if the marzev is kavua be'emtza, if the lead is in the middle of the gutter, yechol Baal HaChatzer lakrom in emtza, ukovo b'shlisha gago b'rivia. He can tell if you move it along the gutter to one third of the way, one quarter of the way, b'chol ota ruach. It has to be on that side. He can't make you take it to another side or put it in another direction. You can face it out this direction. He could just demand of you to move it along the gutter to determine where it is along the gutter, but it's also got to flow out to that side. He can't force you to turn it to face another direction and pour out in a different direction. So those are three different explanations for it. We have the Rashbam's explanation, which means that he can force you to move it to either side of the gutter, but he can't make you take the lead off completely. The way that the Rabbeinu Yosef would suggest that you can't move, he can't force you to move the lead. He can force you to change the direction in which the lead pours out. And then you have the Rabbeinu Chananel, who suggests that the direction in which the lead pours out, he can't make you change, but he can make you change along the gutter where that is placed along the gutter. Those are the three opinions. The Rabbeinu Gershom brings an additional two explanations over here. And he says, if the lead coming off the gutter is always facing a particular direction, that if you have to always keep the lead facing a particular direction, he only keeps it in that direction, it means that the person in control is the Baal HaChatzer. Because the Baal HaChatzer told him where he can let it come out, and he's only there with the permission of the Baal HaChatzer to pour it out in that direction, and therefore the Baal HaChatzer can object at any time. On the other hand, if he goes to two directions, he moves it around and points it wherever he wants, that means that the one who's in control is the owner of the gutter and not the Baal HaChatzer. So if it only pours out in one direction, I mean it's locked into that direction, that seems to be that the Baal HaChatzer is the one who's determining where it's going. On the other hand, if you move it where you please, you turn it to pour out wherever you want, that's an indication that you're in control and that you have the rights here in the chazakah. So in one direction, you don't have a chazaka. In two directions, you do have a chazaka, because it's an indication of who has control over the situation over here. And then he says, Ikadamar, he brings another explanation, which is, Kishalo, tala ela marzev echad berosh echad. It's a case where he only has a lead on one side of the gutter. Aval, tala shnei marzevim mishnei roshim. If he has a lead on both sides of the gutter, and then he has a chazaka. So if the lead is only on one side of the gutter, then he doesn't have a chazaka. If there are leads on both sides of the chazaka and they're pointing out to the same place into the chatzer, then he does have a chazaka, because it's clear here that he's put it in permanently in this way or in a manner which indicates that he has the rights to do it. It's only on one side. It looks like it's either temporary or it's a way to deal with it in the interim, but it's not a permanent solution to the problem. So those are, again, five different ways to explain the difference between ruach achat and shtei ruchot that Shmuel says over here, which is explaining in our Mishnah what's the difference between the marzev ein lo chazaka versus mikomo yesh lo chazaka. Rabbi Chanina amar, ha-marzev ein lo chazaka. The marzev doesn't have a chazaka, which is shema yaroch mikatzro. If it was long, he can cut it shorter, or if it's shorter, he can make it make it longer. But yesh lo mikomo chazaka, shimba lo okro, ein lo okro. If he wants to remove it, he doesn't have a right to remove it. Rabbi Chanina says over here, you can demand of him to shorten or lengthen the lead so that it drops the water in a certain location. What you can't demand of him is that he remove the lead completely. The question amongst the Rishonim, and this has impact la'alocha, is Rabbi Chanina agreeing with Shmuel and adding something on? Or is Rabbi Chanina choleik on Shmuel? Your question would relate to that, which is that does Rabbi Chanina allow you to change the direction of the water flow? That would be like Shmuel. Or does Rabbi Chanina say you're not allowed to change the direction of the water flow? You have to keep the water flowing in that direction, but you can demand of him to either to shorten or lengthen the lead so it drops in that direction further out or closer in. So your right is only to change where it falls in that direction, but you can't change where it points, according to Rabbi Chanina. That will depend on whether Rabbi Chanina accepts Shmuel, and so he's just adding something beyond Shmuel, or whether Rabbi Chanina is being choleik on Shmuel, where he says you can't change the direction, you can only change the length of the pipe in that direction. So Rabbi Yirmi Baba Amar Zev Ein Lo Chazaka Shim Rotzeh Livnot Tachtav Boneh. You're allowed to build underneath it whatever structure you want, and you can demand of him to move the marzev to point away from where you are underneath. But if you want to go higher and you want to force him to take the lead away completely, that you cannot do. So what it's saying is that your right to have the lead there is not a right of the chaser. You don't gain all rights below that lead to say everything in the chaser is now mine underneath the lead. You just have a right of disposal, which means that you could drop your water into the chaser. What you don't have a right is to block his doing what he wants to down below. So he can build down below and just tell you, turn it this way, turn it that way, make it longer, make it shorter. That's assuming that Rabbi Yirmiyahu Baba agrees to the position of Rabbi Chanina and Shmuel. If he completely disagrees with them, then he can say, you have a right to build underneath it, and you just have to deal with the water. And that's what the Rabbeinu Gershom says. The person who builds underneath can decide where he wants to do with the water that's pouring down. He can create whatever he wants. He can put a pipe into his building. He can put a slanted roof that'll have the water wash off. He can do whatever he wants with the building to dispose of the water coming out of your lead. What he can't demand of you is to move your lead. How much he can demand of you to move or change direction or length, that will depend on how much Rabbi Yirmiyahu Abba agrees to Rabbi Chanina and Shmuel's positions before, or whether it's a three-way machloket, and he disagrees completely, and he just says, you can leave the lead there, the guy builds underneath it, and he'll have to deal with the water that's coming off the lead. He has a right to do that. You can't say, don't build underneath my lead. He can do whatever he wants. He'll just have to deal with the water that's coming out. We haven't discussed it yet, but there actually might be a two-way street over here, which is that the person who owns the gutter has a right to dispose of the water into the chaser. But that might also be reflexive, which is that the Bala Chaser might have a right to the water and demand that the water be kept in a certain location because of the fact that he's utilizing the water. So there actually might be a chazaka from both perspectives over here. So far we've only discussed the unidirectional side, which is the person who has the gutter, what rights he has in terms of pouring the water into the chaser below, whether he establishes a chazaka. And number two is, if he does establish a chazaka, what is the nature of that chazaka that he has established? It's not. Our Mishnah says, Amazkila Yeshla Chazaka. The runners or the gutters on the roof have a chazaka. And the Rashbam says, the juxtaposition of the two items in the Mishnah say that whatever doesn't work for the Marzev will work for the Mazkila. And that's what the Gemara is trying to clarify. Bishlama the Mandamar Hanachtarte Shapir. According to the first two opinions that we brought over here, which is Shmuel and Rabbi Chanina, then we can make sense out of the difference over here, which is, one is a permanent structure, and one is not a permanent structure, or you can make a demand to turn the lead in a certain direction, move it in a direction according to Shmuel. You don't have a right to make that demand of a mazchila. Similarly, for Rabbi Chanina, you can make him lengthen or shorten the lead. You can't make him lengthen or shorten the gutter. So that makes sense. Elamand Amar, according to Rabbi Yirmiyahu Baba, who says, Ratzaliv notachta boneh, you can build under the lead, my nafkale mina. Why can't he build under the gutter? What's the difference between building under the lead and building under the gutter? Why do you have rights in the chaser below when it comes to the gutter that you don't have by the marzev or the other way around? Why don't, the same way you don't have rights under the marzev, why you shouldn't have rights under the mazkila? Marzev zacha b'mazkila shel binyan askinan. We're dealing here with a mazkila, a gutter, a runner that is a part of the binyan, the building. Darmalei no lechali de titra ishitai. And he says that I don't want you weakening my foundations over here. Meaning that the way that the Balei HaTosafot explained it over here, and the Rashbam says something similar, is that it's a difference in the nature of how it's built. That the lead is made out of wood, and the mazkila, the gutter or the runner, is made out of stone. So it's a much more of a permanent structure, and therefore he's afraid if you build underneath it, the vibration or the banging is going to cause that structure to break down. Whereas the wood of the marzev won't be affected by it because it's a much more temporary type of structure, and it won't be as impacted by the building that goes on beneath it. Or you could suggest that the gutter, the runner, is closer to the building itself, the wall of the building or the roof of the building. And therefore, you build underneath it, the problem is not the gutter itself, but the fact that you're building so close to the other building is going to cause a weakening of the foundations, which you call the mazkila, to fall down. Whereas the leads, which come off of the building, are further away from the building. Therefore, when you build under them, you're not going to affect that which is above. The Rabbeinu Gershom indicates over here that it's a suyamin avanim min nesid. It's made out of stone and in plaster. And he says, if your binyan, if your building reaches all the way up to the matzchila, it's going to ruin it. There's not enough room for the water to flow, and to go out, they will stick in the gutter, and then they'll cause problems from the wall, because it won't allow for the water to flow through there anymore. Or the other possibility is that when we say the matzchila is made out of stone, it's part and parcel of the building itself. It's not a gutter that's hooked onto the side or separate like the lid is, but rather it's part of the stone structure. There is a groove made into the building or the stone structure itself, and therefore if you were to build under that or near that, you would undermine structurally the whole building or the matzchila versus the marzev, which is an attachment or a lid that runs off of the matzchila, which would not be affected by the building underneath it. Okay, we're going to stop here, five lines down on the top of Nun Tet Amud Aleph.